Eric, we don't quite have quorum yet, but if you want to start with your testimony and present your bill, then we'll, when we get to that point, we'll officially move it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House File 3243 is a pretty straightforward bill, but the details get a little bit hairy. I'll have someone explain them a little bit more. One of the things to keep in mind is this is kind of a temporary problem. The utilities have begun responsibly transitioning their retirement benefits from defined benefit plans to defined contributions. So this is needed while the members that are kind of grandfathered into the old defined benefit plans are still employed. Once they have all retired, this will go away. Everyone will be on defined contributions. Federal law and collective bargaining agreements require certain levels of funding to ensure that adequate levels are maintained in these funds while these members are still working for the companies. And when these contributions exceed the amount of the benefit expense, it is appropriate to allow for the cost recovery through a rate of return and repayment. And to keep another thing I would ask members to keep in mind that this legislation would bring Minnesota in alignment with a similar treatment that is allowed in at least 32 other states and currently for one of the utility companies in Minnesota. The rest of the utility companies are asking for the same treatment. And I'll turn it over to my testifier to get into more of the details.
Thank you, Representative Eric. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Yeah, Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Herb Minke, M-I-N-K-E, and I'm the Vice President of Regulatory Affairs for Minnesota Power in Duluth. I want to thank Representative Eric and the bipartisan co-authors that signed on to this bill, and I appreciate the opportunity to express our support for House File 3243. This bill is supported by Otter Tail Power, Xcel Energy, Merck, and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, which represents a large number of our employees that are covered by this. Prior to leading regulatory affairs at Minnesota Power, I was the director of accounting for Elite in Minnesota Power, where I was responsible for all general accepted accounting principles, FERC, and SEC reporting, including pensions. I was directly responsible for working with the pension actuaries and our outside accountants and recording these items in our books and records. I'm very familiar with the issues we're going to talk about today. The legislature's role in providing policy and rate-making guidance to the Public Utilities Commission throughout the years is pretty well documented. The legislature has directed cost recovery of renewables, conservation efforts, transmission lines, et cetera. The legislature, through statute, dictates which items can be included in rate base and which ones cannot in the rate-making process. The commission has the ability, and this legislation does not change, the ability for the commission to determine just and reasonable rates. Rather, it provides direction and support to an important employee benefit, pensions, recognizing the obligatory funding requirements set forth in federal law. Minnesota utilities acknowledge we are currently allowed to recover annual pension expense and customer rates, but the pension expense is not the total annual cost to pay for pensions. The Pension Protection Act of 2006 requires companies, including utilities, to contribute to their pension plans for the benefit of retirees at levels that exceed the annual expense. Ratepayers aren't making the additional contributions. The company is by issuing additional capital, and the company seeks to earn a return on the additional amounts and provide that return back so that we can continue to provide this benefit for the benefit of our customers. The proposed legislation recognizes there is a benefit to ratepayers from the utility making these required investments in these accumulated contributions in excess of net periodic benefit costs, and simply equalizes the treatment that utility pension assets get as compared to other investments the utility has to make. There's been some concerns expressed that this legislation may be contrary to generally accepted accounting principles, and I assure you that's not the case. The legislation doesn't define generally accepted accounting principles for these issues. Rather, it establishes how prepaid pension assets should be treated once they are recognized. This asset recognition and treatment has been confirmed by several actuaries in the international accounting firms of Price Waterhouse and Deloitte. We feel it is appropriate to have this treatment for pension investments and supports the importance of these benefits on an overall basis. At least 32 states, including North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Michigan, allow their utilities to include prepaid pension assets in rate base and earn a rate of return. Currently, Xcel Energy is the only utility in Minnesota that's allowed to earn a return on these pension assets, and it was confirmed by the commission in their orders in both Xcel's 2013 and 2015 rate cases. Most utilities, including Minnesota Power, have either ended, frozen, or closed their defined benefit pensions to new entrants and moved to 401k plans. Utilities are still required to fund these legacy pension asset programs. Inclusion of these prepaid pension assets as part of rate base increases the certainty on the continuation of these benefits to current employees or retirees. We appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of House File 3243, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Minky. Do you have any other invited testifiers, Representative Burke?
Yes, we do.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you. Amber Lee with Minnesota Energy Resources Corporation. Chair and committee members, my name is Amber Lee, and I manage regulatory and legislative affairs for Minnesota Energy Resources Corporation, or MERC. MERC is a natural gas utility that serves customers throughout the state, about 230,000 customers we have here in Minnesota. MERC is a part of WEC Energy Group, which has electric and gas utilities serving Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Illinois. I would like to thank Senator Rarick and the bill co-authors, and I appreciate the opportunity to express our support for House File 3243. Pensions have been an integral part in the utility industry and natural gas industry specifically. Contributions are a necessary component of maintaining any pension plan and reflect the entirety of costs for utility, as previously stated, and therefore the asset should be treated similarly to any other asset MERC creates to serve our customers. In MERC's instance, we've had a mixed bag of pension recovery in our rate cases since 2008. Minnesota's treatment of these assets has differed for MERC between rate cases, and it has differed between utilities, with one utility allowed to recover, but others disallowed recovery. In our first rate case, filed in 2008, the pension liabilities were included in rate base, and because the prepaid pension account was a liability rather than an asset, the inclusion of these amounts in rate base reduced the overall rate base to customers' direct benefit. In our next case, filed in 2010, the prepaid pension account was no longer a liability, and the inclusion of our pension asset was disallowed, and it has been disallowed in all of our rate cases filed since then. In other words, since 2008, MERC was only allowed to include the pension accounts in rate base when it reduced the utility's overall rate recovery. Because the application of the rule has been one-sided, MERC supports House File 3243 as a way to equalize the recovery principles in cases going forward. To be consistent, the prepaid pension asset should be included in rate base for years in which it is negative and years in which it is positive to achieve long-term balance. The equalization of these principles is important between utilities as well. It is our understanding that in recent years, Xcel Energy has been allowed to include these prepaid assets in rate base. So MERC supports this legislation as a way to consistently equalize the opportunities for all investor-owned utilities in the state. In addition, MERC supports this legislation because it is consistent with the recovery mechanisms in place in other states. As Minnesota Power noted, the recovery of these assets is permitted in our sister jurisdictions in Wisconsin and Michigan, and also via a hybrid recovery mechanism in Illinois. House File 3243 will bring Minnesota's treatment of these assets in line with our neighboring Midwest states. And finally, MERC believes this legislation is in the benefit of our customers. Overall, because of certain conditions specific to MERC, we don't anticipate much impact to rates as a result of this bill, and our customers will see less than a $4 annual impact. And yet our customers benefit from funding to the pension plan, and higher asset values lead to a greater offset to the pension expense. MERC is seeking a balanced approach that benefits both shareholders and customers over time, and inclusion of these prepaid assets as part of rate base provides increased certainty for the continuity of benefits to current employees and retirees. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Representative Burke, do you have any other testifiers? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
you, Madam Chair. My name is Andy Snope. I'm with the IBW Minnesota State Council. The IBW Minnesota State Council represents 16 IBW local unions, representing approximately 15,000 members working in the electrical industry throughout the state of Minnesota. About 6,000 of those members work for a utility company. The IBW supports House File 3243. This legislation will help to add more predictability and stability to the funding of employee pensions. At least 28 other states have allowed some form of pension contribution recovery, and this has turned out to be beneficial for those utility workers around the country. The Federal Pension Protection Act of 2006 require companies to evaluate their pensions funding levels and keep the levels substantially funded for current and future beneficiaries. Allowing this funding as a function of the rate base will help the company stay financially sound and more capable of maintaining a stronger pension funding level. In recent history, electric utilities have been faced with some reductions in legacy energy production. This reduction has led to uncertainties in strong wages and benefits, and quite often uncertainties in employment. All the more reason to consider this legislation for the financial health of the company and the employees who work for them, with hope to someday retire with dignity and strong financial security. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and I hope you can support House File 3243. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Snow. Representative Rarick, any other testifiers?
I believe that's it.
Okay. We do have quorum at this time, and so we're going to take a little bit of business up. And Representative Rarick, would you like to move the minutes from, let's see, the date on here, from March 13th?
I'll move the minutes from March 13th.
All approved. Say aye.
Aye.
Okay, motion prevails. Okay, now to your bill. Representative Rarick, would you like to make a motion to move your bill? It will be going to the General Register.
I would make a motion to move House File 3243 to the General Register.
Representative Rarick makes a motion to refer House File 3243 to the General Register. So we will take up that motion once you're done with all your testifiers. Are there any members from the public that would like to testify before? Oh, thank you. Representative Rarick, do you have no other testifiers, correct?
Okay. I don't have any, but I believe.
Okay, thank you. We have Mr. Grant on the list. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Grant. Please state your name for the record and continue with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Bill Grant. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Energy and Telecommunications at the Department of Commerce, and thanks very much for the opportunity to provide some brief comments on House File 3243. At the Department of Commerce, we're tasked with reviewing all rate increase requests by regulated utilities. We thought it would be helpful for that reason to provide some background information on how pension expenses are treated. When regulated utilities want to raise rates, they petition the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission for review of their current and proposed rates. The Department of Commerce reviews those requests and makes recommendations to the PUC before new rates are set. Under current law, Minnesota's regulated utilities are allowed to fully recover all of their pension expenses from customers through rates. Pension benefits are viewed as a reasonable expense for all employers, including utility companies, so Minnesota regulation has always fully supported rates that include pension expenses, which, as we say in the regulatory world, allow for full recovery from ratepayers. For example, Minnesota Power was just authorized to charge its customers $5.2 million for pension expenses every year for costs of providing pension benefits to its employees. The amount of pension expenses set in a rate case will be charged to utility customers until the utility seeks to update that amount. What House File 3243 does is enable regulated utility companies the ability to charge customers more than the cost of providing pensions. For example, in addition to including all expenses needed to provide pension benefits for all its employees, this bill would allow utilities to charge its customers interest, or what is known as a guaranteed rate of return, on a portion of the pension fund that would go to the utility shareholders. In other words, under this bill, utility customers would have to pay more than once in their utility bills for pension expenses, paying not only for the pension costs, which are currently allowed, as is the practice of the department and the commission, but also paying for utility shareholders' interest on the pension fund. This would be an additional cost to Minnesota's ratepayers. This proposal does not reflect the current accounting standard used in Minnesota utility rate making today. Minnesota uses updated accounting profession standards, which gives utilities a reasonable opportunity to recover their pension costs. I was asked at a hearing in the Senate companion to this bill, and it just came up in testimony from earlier testifiers, whether Xcel Energy isn't receiving different treatment of their pension-related assets than several other utilities. The facts concerning Xcel were quite different, and the impact of the PUC's decision in Xcel's most recent rate case resulted in immaterial impact on customer rates. In contrast, House File 3243 would have a noticeable impact on utility bills while providing no incremental benefit to the security of utility pension funds. I want to reiterate that under current regulatory practice in Minnesota, pension costs will be fully accounted for and fully recovered from utility customers. Thanks. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Representative Mahoney.
Just to be clear, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be clear from the testifier, does that mean the Department of Commerce is opposed to this bill or supportive of this bill?
Mr. Grant.
Chairman, Representative Mahoney, we don't have a position on the bill at this time. We have some concerns with the bill.
Representative Mahoney.
It's a little milquetoast for me. I'm just going to say that you don't like the bill and you are going to have no.
Representative Metza, unless you were first on the list. Sorry, I missed it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Rarick, thank you for taking this forward. I actually went and met with Minnesota Power, had some good conversations about the concerns here, and met with some of the line men and women whose pensions are affected when a rate increase doesn't go through and gets denied at the PUC level. And, you know, I have faith in our government agencies and bureaucracies. However, we found a surprise last year in a deal that was made in regard to the RDF fund and the biomass for both Virginia Hibbing and other folks involved, Benson and St. Paul. And what I found out in some of your paperwork buried in Department of Commerce was a clause that said you shouldn't renew those contracts 9 years from now because it's too expensive, putting us and our communities in a position where there were significant investments made. And, you know, I think those were promises the legislature made. People made some big decisions based on that, and there was never any notification sent out to anyone that that was your recommendation. It was buried in the paperwork. And so, you know, I'd agree with Representative Mahoney in saying that's a milquetoast answer, and it'd be nice to know what your concerns are specifically in regard to this, and more specifically, what you're referring to in terms of Xcel being different, and some of those clarifying points, because avoiding an answer isn't going to do any good when what I think we have before us is a really good bill for both the employees and fair to the consumers and ratepayers and the utilities.
And before I go to you, Commissioner Grant, the two newest members in the committee, Representative New and Representative Munson, what you are seeing here is Iron Range Alzheimer's. They forget everything but the grudges. So just wanted to make sure you guys were informed on that. Commissioner Grant, if you wish to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I thought that was a pretty funny joke. I'm sorry. I thought that was okay. So, sorry.
I smiled.
Yeah, okay. Commissioner Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Metza, I don't think you wanted me to respond to the question about the Renewable Development Fund, but rather about this bill. And I have to be clear, I'm not a utility regulatory accountant. I have regulatory accountants that work for me, and the details of this issue get into a level of detail that I'm not prepared to go into. I think it would be helpful if we were to sit down with the experts and have that discussion. It gets pretty deep in a hurry, and so I'd be happy to do that, and I think that would be a good place to start.
Representative Mensa?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and would that be in Virginia soon? Or?
All right. Any further? Representative Mahoney, back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to go back to the author. What I took away from the testimony so far is that you're looking to be able to charge customers for the cost of the pensions, which I think is fair. I mean, I think that's appropriate. But from the testimony I got from Mr. Grant is that you'll be charging interest or a guaranteed profit on that $2 or $4 or whatever the dollar amount is when the principle this is based off of, which is the Excel's ability to do that, they can't. Am I understanding this correctly? And was that your intent, that the shareholders would profit from your bill as opposed to just the employees of the utility?
And before I go to you, Representative Rarick, members, I apologize. I was late to the committee, so maybe I picked up on this. Can nonpartisan staff or some – I'm hearing this term guaranteed return, and I'm trying to figure out where this is coming from. Can someone tell me what part of the debate I'm missing here? Because I've heard the testifier say it, and I heard you say it, Representative Mahoney. No one?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Eloff.
I believe what the issue is here is that the company is asking that the pension contributions in excess of what gets paid out in the next year be allowed to earn the rate of return that the utility has been allowed to earn as a result of its most recent rate case by the PUC.
Okay, so is that the case? Okay, so that sounds like a... Well, it sounds like a good thing to me. We would want that because the alternative is we don't do that. And then pension, well, I'm asking you, I'm making a statement, not asking you. Sorry. Okay, where were we? you asked
Chair,
a question.
I was going to respond.
Representative Breck, do you want to answer that or do you want to have one of your testifiers come up and answer it?
Mr. Chair, I can attempt, and if I am wrong, I'm sure okay. I can be corrected. But it was my understanding that this is exactly it, that there's a defined amount that the utility is required to put aside for pension expenses. And typically that expense amount is not reached. And so they want what's left over to be able to be invested to be able to earn interest, which then in turn goes back in. And when we say it, the stakeholders or the investors, but in many cases of these companies, that is the ratepayers themselves. But so that money is going to be able to earn interest, which will be able to go back into the utility to help cover costs, is my understanding.
Okay. So Representative Mahoney, Representative Rarick, again, my apologies for getting caught up to speed, but the single biggest contributor to pension funds is growth in the investment earnings, which the longer it's in there, the more you have the benefit of the power of compound interest there to leverage it. So that's my understanding of why we would want to make these contributions now as opposed to in 10 or 15 years, because you actually, in fact, save the ratepayers' money. It's the exact same thing with public pensions. Ignoring the problem makes you end up like Illinois. So I wasn't aware that there were concerns with this bill. I still don't know. I don't understand the concerns with the bill, but that's okay. I don't need to understand that. So is there any other questions or comments from members of the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
What I'd like to clarify is, so is the interest earned off of this surcharge on the rates or the increase in rates that is being presented as a pension fix, is that interest going back into the pension funds, as the chair alluded to? That's the biggest contributor to pensions, is that interest, earned interest, or is it going back to operating costs? Because I've had people in my office on this particular bill. I thought it was just fine, but if that interest is going back to the ratepayers. That interest should be used for the pension, not for operating costs. So that's my question, is if they earn $1,000 in interest on this charge, of whether it's $2 or $4 or even more, does that go and stay in that pension plan, the defined benefit, defined contribution plan, or does it go back to be used as operating costs to make sure that the lines, the grid system is operating, or the boiler is firing at the correct rate? That's the question I have. Where is that interest money going?
If you could restate your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Garofalo. My name is Herb Minkey. I'm with Minnesota Power. Let me see if I can attempt to clarify this, because it's an excellent question, sir. You have two entities. You have the utility. You have the pension plan. The more money we put into the pension plan, the more it returns, as Chair Garofalo said, and reduces the annual pension expense. That pension expense is an algorithm defined by actuaries that then gets charged to the utility. That amount that Mr. Grant said was $5 million, and that's approximately the amount that was at our test year for our last rate case, gets recovered through rates. What we're talking about here is the additional amounts that we have to pay over and above that that actually get paid into the pension plan by the company. So to make those payments, the company has gone out, issued stock, it's issued debt, has funded those additional funds into the pension plan, which does increase its earnings and does decrease the pension expense. Okay, so I think you have that part exactly right. What we're talking about here is the additional funds we've had to put in, earning a return on that investment like any other investment we've had. First off, we don't have a guaranteed rate of return. The rate of returns that have been allowed in our last rate cases, we have under-earned that for a long period of time on an overall basis. What we're asking for, and the amount that we have at 12/31/17 off of, I've got a page out of our 10K, we've got about $70 million that we've funded in over and above that $5 million annual amount, and it's different every year, but approximately that $5 million amount every year. What we're asking for is a rate of return on that $70 million so we can pay that, pay for those, that stock and that debt that we've issued to generate those funds to contribute into the pension plan. Okay. I hope that clarifies your question.
Any other questions or comments from members? I think we've beat this dead horse enough. Representative Roark, any closing comments from you?
I know it's a complicated issue, but I do hope that members can support it. It seems to be to make sense. So.
My apologies. I've been informed that this is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll close the public comments. We'll take that as your closing comment, Representative Rarick. And Representative Rarick renews his motion to have House File 3243 recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Rarick. Representative New, can we take Representative Eklund first because he's not on the committee?
Yep.
Representative Eklund.
Mr. Chair, can I move my friend's bill?
You have a friend?
Sorry. Not many, Mr. Chair.
Do you have a job or something?
All right, Representative Metza moves House File 2853 for possible inclusion in a later bill. Representative Eklund, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for hearing this bill. House File 2853 is a bill for Cook County Higher Ed. And first off, I want to thank you for last year's appropriation to Cook County Higher Ed. We really appreciate it. So Cook County Higher Ed, the residents of Grand Marais and Cook County are 120 miles from the nearest higher ed institution they go to. Cook County Higher Ed has catered to the workforce and needs of Cook County in the past. They've tailored programs to the needs that they have. Some examples are they supply nurses and CNAs for the hospital. And this year they're starting a culinary arts program in response to what the resort community has needed up there. They're having a hard time finding chefs. So it's just a couple examples of what they do, and it's a terrific program. And now I'd like to turn it over to Karen Blackburn, the director of Cook County Higher Ed, and she can explain to the committee more details.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed to testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Karen Blackburn. I am the Executive Director of Cook County Higher Education. Thank you, Representative Eklund, for your support. I appreciate the opportunity to share our story and needs with you today. You have a handout in your packet that gives additional background. Last year, Paula Sundet Wolf spoke to you, and after 22 years as director, she retired last summer, and I'm here to carry out the mission. For over 20 years, Cook County Higher Education has been collaborating with regional colleges and universities to provide certificates, degrees, and workforce training to the residents of Cook and Lake County. Our campus is located in Grand Marais, which is on Lake Superior, just 40 miles south of the Canadian border. It is the end of the road. It's 120 miles and 2.5 hours drive to the nearest campus. We are home to 5,000 residents. 92% of our land is public land, and 50% of our homes are owned by non-residents, and our tourism industry serves 5 million people per year. Our job at Cook County Higher Ed is to provide educational opportunities that support our residents and our businesses. Each year, we serve between 50 and 150 people in degree programs, and this year we have just had just under 600 students in our workforce trainings alone. That is 10% of our population. We are really flexible in our programming, and we were able to quickly meet the needs of our local businesses and employees by providing local certificates and workforce training. And no one needs to travel 2.5 hours to get training. Our degree students have a 90% graduation rate, which often results in the graduate doubling their wages in our community. And we have a staff of 4. We are very busy. I come to you today to request $150,000 in workforce development funds to support 2 workforce development opportunities. As in most of Minnesota, Cook County is experiencing a labor shortage. Our tourism industry has historically relied on an influx of international workers, but with all the federal visa programs in flux this year, we decided we needed to come up with our own solution. So we've formed a partnership between my organization, our local school district, the resort owners, Hibbing Community College, Advanced Minnesota, and IRRRB to bring an accredited culinary school to Cook County. The school will be located at the brand new state-of-the-art culinary facility at the high school, a $1.2 million project that was funded by local bonding. We will recruit students from out of the area and out of the state and give them jobs and housing at the resorts. Affordable housing is also a problem in Cook County. And they can simultaneously earn a culinary degree while working and apprenticing at the local restaurants. These classes will also be available to interested high school students for college credit and for recent graduates that are remaining in the county and other non-traditional local students. 2 recent culinary schools have closed, Le Cordon Bleu and Dunwoody, and one of the reasons is that the debt the students graduate with cannot be supported by the entry-level wages earned in the industry. Our partnership with Advanced Minnesota and IRRRB and the resort owners will allow some of the students to graduate with little or no debt and go directly into jobs in our community. As an accredited program, students are also eligible for FAFSA. It is an amazing opportunity for our local residents and our large and small resort and restaurant owners. Our second opportunity is in the healthcare programming. Again, the problem is not unique to our community, but our solution is. There's a need for all healthcare workers in Cook County. Our current hospital has acute need for RNs and LPNs, and then traditional needs for CNAs, TMAs, lab techs, EMTs, and paramedics. In addition, the City of Grand Marais is working with Spectrum, a provider of assisted care and memory care facilities, to build a 30-bed facility in Cook County. This is a gap in our continuum of care in Cook County. People that have lived and grown up there have to leave the county if they need this kind of service. The need for 30 beds has been proven. The land has been offered. But Spectrum needs assurance that the skilled labor force is available before they come there. We would like to provide a consistent 2-year programming for our residents that allows them to continue their nursing degrees while living and working and raising their families in Cook County. To provide this local classes taught by accredited state colleges, we need a critical mass of 13 to 15 students. If we cannot enroll that many students, we will need to pay for the empty seats. All of the tuition dollars from these classes flow through to the accredited institution, Lake Superior College, Bemidji State University, or Hibbing Community College. This tuition model is the same for all of our post-secondary degree programming. We help students identify long-distance education education opportunities, enroll in the programs, apply for financial aid, and then once they get in, we support them through their programming. We do this by offering free tutoring. We have a 24-hour access to our campus where they can use our technology, and we provide any help with any problems that come up. And we do that all for free. We collaborate with nearly 20 institutions of higher learning across Minnesota, and we collaborate with Advanced Minnesota as part of our workforce development work. It is a fantastic model. It is working, but we cannot do it alone. Our current budget is $350,000. Our revenue source is local supporters, regional grants, and state funding. We received a $40,000 one-time grant from you last year. In closing, these funds will enable us to continue to provide all the benefits of a college institution without the enormous infrastructure expense of a campus, provide tuition dollars to your regional colleges and universities, and improve the lives of our residents and allow our businesses to thrive with skilled employees. Thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Representative Eklund, do you have any other testifiers?
Nope, that's it, Mr. Chair.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member comments and questions. Any questions from members of the committee? Representative Metza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think it's important to note that the community did have a significant local match in the referendum that they passed and really put the state in a good position to support something that they're supporting themselves.
Representative Eklund, any closing comments?
No, Mr. Chair, this is a good program, and I'd certainly hope that we can get it included in the final bill.
Right, with that, Representative Metza renews his motion to have House File 2853 laid over for possible inclusion in a later bill. Thank you, Representative Eklund, and thank you to our testifier.
Thank you.
Representative New, you're the final bill of the day, House File 2937. And Representative New moves that House File 2937 be considered for... Representative New moves that House File 2937 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative New, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have an amendment. Would you like me to move that first?
Thank you. Representative New moves the A180597 amendment. Looks like you're just deleting Section 2 of the bill. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, we're just conforming to the Senate version of the bill.
All those in favor of the amendment, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just briefly, the purpose of House File 2937 is to update and simplify provisions of the existing pay-for-performance program at DEED. And I just want to emphasize a couple things. One, this program invests in those with the most challenges and pays only for long-term results. It requires placement into good jobs with health benefits and a 12-year job retention. In addition, there's a significant return on investment to the state. For every dollar spent on the program, we get $7 back via increased taxes, reduced public subsidies, and reduced criminal justice costs. And with that, I would love to turn the time over to the testifier. She can run through the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Leslie Dwight. It is my pleasure to testify today on behalf of Twin Cities Rise in support of House File 2937. Twin Cities Rise is a community-based job training program that transforms lives out of poverty through personal empowerment, career training, and meaningful employment. We serve Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the metro area. Since 1998, Twin Cities Rise has placed thousands of low-income adults with the most barriers to long-term stable employment into full-time, meaningful jobs that paid on average about $14 per hour in 2017, or nearly $29,000 per year. This is an increase of over $22,000 from when these individuals started the program. Job retention is high at 80% after 12 months, more than two times the rates of similar programs nationwide. As you know, the need for Twin Cities Rise continues. Employers are desperate for skilled workers who come ready to learn and grow on the job. Those we serve have been left behind, chronically under and unemployed. They need the resources and support from programs like Twin Cities Rise to build skills, engage with the labor market, and be successful on the job. House File 2937 makes changes to Minnesota Statute 116J.8747. This statute was passed about 20 years ago when Twin Cities Rise partnered with the Minnesota legislature to create an innovative pay-for-performance statute that pays job training programs only for long-term transformative results. House File 2937 proposes minor changes to update and simplify the bill. The most critical change is focused on the eligibility requirements for individuals. We're proposing using 100% of the federal poverty level to determine eligibility for the performance-based payments under the statute. Federal poverty guidelines are based on household income and family size. This change is proposed for two reasons. First, it updates the statute to be consistent with how other programs determine eligibility for services used by low-income adults, removing individual income, the asset qualification, and dependent status from the statute, the existing statute. Using the federal poverty guidelines is the standard in the field and is also a measure that is automatically updated every year. Second, using the federal poverty guidelines focuses the statute on those who need it most, which is consistent with the original intent 20 years ago. The change allows single parents who previously would not have been eligible to now qualify based on income guidelines that account for family size. Let me just give you an example. So a single individual will still qualify at about the same level. In 2017, 100% of the federal poverty level for one person was $12,060. So that's consistent with the current statute language. For a family of four, however, the poverty level is at $24,600. So this would changing to the federal poverty guidelines would give single parents the opportunity to qualify at a higher level since they're supporting more people in their family. The other two changes include removing the requirement for the length of time in the training program and simplifying the reporting to be consistent with current practice. In terms of the length of time, we have found that employers want to hire trainees more quickly and program participants want to get to work faster. Twin Cities Rise is responding to this need. We continue to provide support both pre- and post-placement to assure long-term success on the job, but expect the total length of time in months to decrease. Training may look different. It may have more hours per week, for example, or more intensive programming during the first few months of employment. And I just also want to note that because the statute pays providers based on outcomes, we are accountable to achieving the long-term outcomes in the statute. How we do it may change and probably needs to change over time, but we aren't paid if we don't meet the high standards set forth in the statute. Finally, in terms of reporting, a lot has changed in 20 years. The state already requires extensive reporting through Section 116L.98, which Twin Cities Rise has been doing for a number of years. We propose removing the old language and replacing it with the reference to this Section 116L.98 to update the statute based on current practice. As Representative Du mentioned, you also have before you an author's amendment. We removed language regarding the minimum wage under the advice and guidance of legislators who were concerned about the inclusion of that language. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm happy to stay for questions.
Hey, Representative New, do you have any other testifiers?
No.
This is a public hearing. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify in favor or voice concerns with the bill? Seeing none, we'll move on to member comments and questions. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to know a little bit more about the difference between the reporting requirements that were in the bill and the ones in 116L.98. Are there any of those seven that are eliminated by removing that list?
That's fire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, representative. So the seven, I think they're all in the existing reporting that we're doing. You know, the deed has really changed the way that providers report to the state, and so there's an extensive database that we put our data into. And that, of course, wasn't in existence when the bill was originally created 20 years ago. So this language really dates back to that original time when it was created.
Mr. Clark? So let me clarify. So all seven of these are still in the database, plus there's additional ones? Is that what you're saying?
To the testifier.
Yes, Mr. Chair. and members of the committee. So the only one that I'm not sure about are the number five, the amount of employer fees paid to the program. But the other ones are all asked in existing reporting.
Mr. Chairman, is there a reason you wouldn't want number five in there?
No. I mean, we're actually happy to do this reporting. It's just an added burden to do both.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, what is the added burden that you're talking about? You said it's just one provision?
It's a testifier.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. So because we do such extensive reporting through the existing deed practices, this is just an added piece that we need to do, and we're actually happy to do it. And so we don't feel strongly about removing it, but we did it just to simplify the statute.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, let me just say, first of all, I think RISE is an incredible program. It's a very good program, and thank you for bringing the bill before us. One of the things that has been to your credit is that you have indicated the investment in the match and the other points that are made here, and it is a pay-for-performance. And, you know, we invested in you early because you had all of those kinds of things for us to look at, and I think that was terrific. And I guess I'm just wondering if we start eliminating some of them, do we start to see, you know, the performance go down? It's not required. Nobody's tracking it. That would just be a question that I have. And I guess I'm wondering, since you're going to, part of what you do is remove the six-month training, will you be keeping track of how long people are trained? Because it does seem to me, you know, there's some relationship between training that people get and the kind of jobs that they're able to get and the kind of salaries that they're able to earn and so on. And if they start decreasing, it said that some employers, they want to hire them more quickly. They don't want to wait for the six-month training. Is there any way that you're going to keep track of that in terms of, you know, like you have such a great success, and if some of that starts to change, will we know if it's affecting the success of your program in any way?
So testifier.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, definitely we keep track of that. So we carefully track data on the length of time in training. And that has been a concern, that as that time has decreased, we want to make sure that our retention continues to stay the same. And so we will definitely keep track of that and be able to provide data on the impact of that as well.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm actually supporting this bill. I have had my conversations with RISE over the years, and I've never been a huge supporter of pay-for-performance workforce training. So having said that, I fully support this. They are getting rid of three or four particulars, but it is being picked up in the 116L.98, which was something that was put into place about 6 years ago. It covers most everything that is on their list of reporting that they were reporting before. It doesn't take into account employee fees or any of the money that they might raise from separate entities. But the idea of having all of our workforce programs reporting in the same fashion, so that at any time we as legislators want to compare one program to another to see which one is doing the right thing and which one is not doing the right thing, and be able to base our budgetary decisions on an apples-to-apples comparison. This is actually a pretty good bill, and I think it will be even more important in the next period. We are farther away from a recession than we are closer to one, and we are draining the workforce monies pretty rapidly. And when we do come into a recession, many of these workforce programs, which we are funding out of workforce, will not be able to be funded. And we as a committee should be looking at that, because we went from taking about $16 million to taking about $37 million out of workforce. So if tariffs and a variety of other particular issues come up and force us into a problem. We are going to have an awful lot of workforce training facilities coming to our door looking for money, and we will not have it because we have now used the workforce as a super slush fund rather than just a minor slush puddle. So I actually support this bill. I support dropping out some of the requirements that RISE is asking for in this and switching over to the apples-to-apples comparison.
Representative New, any closing comments?
No, I just appreciate your support.
With that, Representative New renews her motion to have House File 2937 as amended, recommended to pass and refer to the General Register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevailed. Members, that completes our agenda for the day. We will be adjourning now. Have a good day. We are adjourned.